As I was thinking about this lesson last week, there was a headline that just kind of popped up on my news feed. And isn't it funny how the tech companies know what you're thinking about and they just kind of feed you like they're reading your mind? But the title of this headline was "Child Psychologist Reveals Parenting Habits That Create Struggling Adults." So I was intrigued by that. It's been on my mind thinking about this lesson, so I clicked. But according to this child psychologist, he says that we're doing our children a disservice when we make things easy for them. He believes that modern parenting is all about making things, as he says, smooth and safe and happy. And he argues that that's not what children need. They need to be challenged with problems that they can't easily figure out. They need situations in life that are just a little bit dangerous. Not too dangerous, but somewhat dangerous. And they don't always need to be happy. Easy, smooth, safe, and happy is not life. That is not reality. And we're not preparing our children for life if everything we do is to smooth things out, bubble wrap them, simplify, and make things as happy as possible. This child psychologist, who is a professor in New York, Daniel Moran, said that the intention of this kind of parenting is love, but the outcome, he says, is dependency. When parents remove discomfort quickly, he says, children never get to develop coping skills, which can be problematic later in life. He said, quote, "From a behavioral science perspective, children learn confidence by experiencing consequences and discovering that they can handle them." He added that true resilience comes from learning to stay present, feel the hard stuff, and keep moving forward. That's what matters. And I'm just going to identify three common habits that he says stunt independence. Number one, fixing instead of coaching, which is jumping in anytime you see your child have a problem they can't figure out instead of letting them figure it out on their own. Number two, this is interesting, overpraising. Overpraising. Telling a child that they're amazing no matter what they do. It removes, he says, the learning value of effort and feedback. And then thirdly, overscheduling. Endless adult organized activities leave little room for boredom, which he says is a place where creativity and self-direction grow. What he advises parents to do is let them struggle safely. It's okay that they make a mistake. A mistake, he says, is an opportunity for growth. My daughter is an OT. My daughter, who just had twins and has a little 18-month-old, and I can see her occupational therapy therapist coming out with our little 18-month-old. When little Rose can't figure something out, Anna just says, "Figure it out. Figure it out." And when she messes up and she gets frustrated and she starts to cry, she says, "Dry it up." And my wife thinks that she's a little too harsh with Rose. I mean, that's a grandparent talking. But I appreciate what she's trying to do, and our son-in-law as well. If we want, and this is another quote, "If we want confident, capable young adults, we have to let kids practice being uncomfortable. Confidence doesn't come from constant praise. It comes from persistence, problem-solving, and purpose. A little discomfort today can build the psychological flexibility they'll need tomorrow. These professionals are discouraging the helicopter parenting. You may have heard that phrase. The over-parenting. Kids don't need that. They don't even want that. They want to be independent. They want to struggle and figure things out on their own. That creates resilience, and that resilience and self-determination are going to help them later in life. Another psychologist said, same article, doing everything for your child when they can physically do things for themselves trains them to depend on you for everything instead of being proud and confident in what they can master on their own. What this psychologist said is to demonstrate the task first, let the child try it while you observe without interference, then step away and show trust. She said, when you leave the room, you show that you're confident in your child and promote a feeling of happiness and pride. Now, I've just done a lot of talk, and I did this Sunday morning in the class period with another social psychologist. You're not here to listen to what psychologists have to say. I've told you all that to say this. This kind of parenting should sound familiar to us, because it's what we see in the Bible. No, the Bible is not a manual on how to parent children. And this lesson tonight is not going to be all the do's and don'ts of parenting. That's not what this lesson is about. What we're going to do tonight, and I appreciate Josh leading us in a song that talks about the Lord as our Father, as our Shepherd, and the way He trains us. What we see in the Bible is God as a Father training His children. And I believe we can learn so many lessons from following His example. And what these psychologists are saying is what God does in the Bible, it really does work. We've seen it in our practice. That struggle is good. That frustration, even, is helpful. That having to figure things out, that learning through discipline and instruction, as we're going to look at tonight, is really what children thrive. That's when they thrive. We've talked this whole weekend about how God is involved in this great transformation of us as people. He has taken us, though we were dead, though we were lifeless, though we were given over to sin and temptation, though we were hopeless in many ways, Ephesians chapter 2. And He has brought life out of death. He has brought this new way of thinking where we were callous and walking in darkness. God is bringing us into the light. And this transformation is brought about not by easy. It's brought about by hard. All day yesterday we talked about marriage. Marriage is not easy. It's not supposed to be easy. There's a reason why God made us the way we are, so that we have struggle in marriage. It's because there's no other way that we can learn things like patience. There's no other way that we can learn things like sacrifice and unconditional love. You're not going to learn those things when it's easy. And so what God has given us in this relationship called marriage is a training ground, a proving ground, where we are disciplined, where we learn through experience, not just academically. We learn through experience what the love of Christ is all about. So we're going to talk tonight, as we close out the series, about the last relationship in this series of relationships that began in chapter 5. We talked about wives and husbands. Now we're going to talk about children and parents. And we're especially going to look at verse 4, what Paul says to fathers. But I want to put this verse in the broader context of what we've been looking at the last few days. Let's back up to chapter 5 and read again from verses 18 through 21. Chapter 5, verse 18 through 21. Paul says, "And do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit, addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with your heart, giving thanks always and for everything to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ." And so this is yet another time in the book of Ephesians where Paul talks it up about us being filled, in this case, with the Spirit. We are filled that we might take on the character of God. Well, how does this happen? We talked about the three ways. We do it through worship, singing, psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. We do it secondly through giving thanks, verse 20. But the third way is the lead into these relationships where he says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And of course, he begins with wives. Wives, submit to your husbands. You're going to learn this submission. You're going to be filled with all the fullness of God by learning submission in marriage. But husbands have to submit also. Husbands have to submit to the character of Christ. They must love their wives as Christ loved the church. He's later going to say to bondservants, they must submit. They've got to obey their earthly masters. And then he says to children that they must submit. In chapter 6 and verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. So all of these relationships are built on this idea that we are coming on to the knowledge of God. We are learning and being trained to be filled with the Spirit by submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. Let me say something about verses 1 through 3 before we get to verse 4, though. He says in verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And then he quotes from the fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. You ever notice that the fifth commandment is kind of the bridge in between the first four and the last five? The first four are the vertical commandments that have to do with our relationship to God. You shall have no other gods before me, no graven images, don't take the Lord's name in vain, keep the Sabbath day holy. All right? What are the last five commandments have in common? They all have to do with our horizontal relationships with one another. Don't steal, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't bear false witness, don't covet. Those are horizontal. Why did God put, and I don't know this, but isn't it interesting that the fifth commandment straddles those two? What is the relationship between the fifth commandment and the first four? What are children learning when they learn to respect their parents? What are they learning when they honor and obey their father and their mother? They're learning respect for God. How else are they going to learn that unless they learn it from their parents? What's the relationship between the fifth commandment and the last five commandments? Are horizontal. Well, if children don't learn to respect their mother and father, are they going to respect their neighbor? Or are they going to think the world revolves around them? You see, it just makes sense that this commandment is placed where it is. It is essential that our children learn submission. And we'll come back to that in just a moment. But that brings us to verse 4, where he says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. This word discipline, paideia, is the Greek word, simply means training, learning, instruction, chastening, discipline. It's translated a number of ways. It's used most often in the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 12, which we're going to look at a little bit later, where it's describing God's discipline of us as His children. The second word, instruction, is this Greek word, nouthesia, which simply means admonition, teaching. And so how are children to be brought up in the Lord? It's through discipline, through chastening, through correction, but also through instruction. We are to teach and we are to discipline. They are to learn by being trained as well as being taught. What does this look like in a Christian home? Does the Bible give us any help with understanding what discipline and instruction means? I believe that it does. It does by showing us the character of God as a father. Most of what we learn about parenting is how God trains His children. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at primarily three passages. We're going to look, first of all, at Deuteronomy 8 and Hebrews 12 as we think about this concept of discipline. And then we're going to finish up with Deuteronomy chapter 6 and say a few things about instruction. And then finish out with a word about our stewardship implied here in Ephesians 6 and verse 4. And so let's begin. Turn your Bibles over to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. The context of this chapter is when Moses, in the plains of Moab, is instructing the second generation that's come out of bondage in Egypt. You remember, the first generation all died in the wilderness for 40 years, as God had said. And now the second generation is about to go in to the promised land and receive this land flowing with milk and honey. And what Moses is doing here in Deuteronomy 8, as well as in many other places, is he's saying, remember. Remember. That's the key word in Deuteronomy 8. Don't forget what you learned in the wilderness. And what he gives us in the first several verses is a clue as to why the wilderness was necessary, how God was using the wilderness. And I want you to think, before we read this, of what the wilderness represents to us today, because this is a theme that runs throughout the Bible. What is the wilderness to us? It's the in-between time between slavery and the promised land. And that imagery is used throughout the New Testament. When were we slaves, just like the Israelites? It's before we became Christians, before we passed through the waters of baptism and were freed on the other side. But we're not yet in the promised land. We're not yet in heaven. We're longing for that. It's this in-between time where what's happening? We're going through struggle. We're going through hardship. But that hardship and that struggle is good. It's purposeful. It's designed intentionally by God to do what? To prepare us for what He's made us for. So we're free, we're no longer in slavery, but we're not yet in the promised land. And God's using this in-between time to discipline us and chasten us, to prepare us as a father prepares his children. Let's read together the first several verses of Deuteronomy 8. The whole commandment that I command you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers. And you shall remember, there's the key word, the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you. And let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. So you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God by walking in his ways and by fearing him. We'll read a little bit more later. But this is the idea. What do our children need? Our children need humility. So much of modern parenting is about building up self-esteem. And I'm not saying we don't praise our kids. But what God saw his children needed was humility. Why did they not obey God? Why did they not go in and take the promised land? It's because of pride. Because they weren't listening to God. They weren't trusting in God. God used the wilderness as a way of... It wasn't just punishment. It was punishment. But it was more than just punishment. It was a way of teaching them humility, of dependence on God. Humility does not come easy. Humility is something that you have to learn the hard way. What do we associate most with the wilderness? When you think about the book of Numbers and you think about the children of Israel going through the wilderness and Moses dealing with them for 40 years, what's the first word that comes to your mind? The first word that comes to my mind is grumbling. Do your kids ever grumble and complain? You ever been on a long road trip? That's kind of what I think of. I don't know why. When I read about Moses and the Israelites, is I think about a big old bus, you know, with all of these kids in the back seat, and Moses is up there driving, and they're like complaining in the back. They're on this long road trip that lasts for 40 years. Are we there yet? And they're always complaining. They're always grumbling. What's God teaching? He's teaching them discipline. Part of their discipline was not giving in to their complaints. What's one of the things that they complained about? Food. Your kids ever complain about food on a long road trip? What did God do? Oh, I'm so sorry. Let's stop off and give you whatever you want. And that's one of the problems in our society. Our society, unlike few that have ever existed, we have the opportunity as parents to almost give our children most everything that they want. And we can do it just like that. You don't have to drive very far the road, and there's an exit and an unlimited supply of junk food, right? I'm not saying it's wrong to ever splurge and allow your kids to enjoy maybe even things that are not completely healthy for them. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is our children must learn humility. God knew that them eating manna every day for 40 years was a good thing for them. Limiting them to only eating manna. And by the way, you know what manna, the word, or what it was? It tasted like honey. It tasted like honey. What was the promised land full of? Milk and honey. What's God doing in the wilderness? He's giving them a little taste of the promised land. Isn't that interesting? I don't think that's by accident. What's the best way that we can teach our children humility? Number one, don't give them everything that they want. Even though you can give them probably most things that they desire. Don't do it. In a land of unlimited choices, limit them. Number two, teach them submission to authority. They must learn that, and that's part of humility. They must learn that the world does not revolve around them. Let's continue in the reading in verse 7. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, fountains and hills, flowing out in the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper, and you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Does that sound familiar to you? Are we not living in a land flowing with milk and honey in America today? It's a danger. It's a blessing we need to thank God for, but it's a danger at the same time. Verse 11, take care lest you forget. That's the other side of remembering. Lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and your gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up. That's the opposite of pride. And you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through the great and terrifying wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. It's so easy living in a prosperous country like ours, a land flowing with milk and honey, for our children to grow up with the lie in their heart that yes, in fact, the world does revolve around me. Everything in the world is here to meet my needs. And we can feed into that pride, parents, by giving them everything that they want. We are not doing them any favors when we do that. And when they grumble, if I can quote my my daughter, dried up, no whining. That was rule number one in the wilderness, no whining. There will be consequences. And we're not going to reward whining with giving you whatever you want. The world does not revolve around them. And so, number one, don't give them everything that they want. Number two, teach them submission to authority. It's about God. Well, before it's about God, it's about mom and dad and what mom and dad say. And you will respect that, so that someday you'll respect what God says. And then thirdly, by giving thanks. Verse 17, beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers as it is this day. It's so tempting for us as parents to give our kids whatever they want. God, by the way, God could have given his children whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted it. But God knew that was not what was best for them. He wanted to teach them humility. He made things hard, not because he was mean or hateful, but so that they might learn to rely on him and not trust in themselves. Children need this. Our children depend on this. Children not only need humility, they need training. They need discipline. They are humbled by discipline. Humility is a subset or an outgrowth of discipline. They are related. But let's talk about how humility and other characteristics can be trained into our children through intentional discipline. Let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 12 now. I'm sorry, I'm behind. Here's the fill in the blanks for the kids that are filling this out. That he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart. He humbled you, let you hunger and fed you with manna. Hebrews chapter 12, let's turn over there. This is our second passage on discipline, on the broad topic of discipline, where this word is actually used several times, the same word that occurs over in Ephesians 6 and verse 4. But before we read this, let's also understand the context. Paul here is using an analogy of a father training his child in the middle of another analogy. It's kind of interesting. What the Hebrew writer is doing in the broader context is talking about endurance. He compares the Christian life to a race. He says in chapter 12 and verse 1, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus. And so he's encouraging us to run and to finish our race, following the example of our founder, the founder of our faith. And then he comes back to this analogy in verse 12. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. And he talks in more detail about how we do make straight paths for our feet. And so the broader context of Hebrews 12 is this race that we're running, and especially this idea of endurance. This is not a sprint. This is a marathon. This is a long race. Okay, we don't need just short bursts of energy. We need a sustained effort over a lifetime where if we're going to finish this race. But what do you need to do to complete a long race? You need training. You don't just wake up some morning and say, you know what, I think I'm going to run a marathon today. That's not how it works. You have to train for weeks, even months and years, to build up a base to be able to run a long distance. And what he says is we need the kind of discipline, we need the kind of training that a father provides for his children. And so in the middle here, he uses this analogy of God being our father. Let's begin in verse 3. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now, I'm going to work this passage in reverse. What the Hebrew writer is doing is he's assuming that you all understand the importance of discipline. We all know that fathers have to discipline and train their children. That's why God has to discipline us. It's not that God has forgotten us. It's not that God has forsaken us. When we're struggling, when we're going through hard times, even if it means bloodshed, even if it costs us our life, understand that God is doing this for us for our good. If we didn't go through this, it would mean he doesn't love us. That's the argument of the Hebrew writer, is from the lesser to the greater. What we're going to do is we're going to go from the greater to the lesser. We're going to talk about God, the reason why God disciplines us, and argue that's the way we should discipline our children. And so what do we learn here about child training? Let me point out just three verses here. First of all, verse 9, he says, besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we did what? We respected them. Why did we respect them? Because they did nothing but compliment us and tell us how wonderful we were? No, they respected us because we disciplined them. I promise that I would not tell too many Rose stories. I've got lots of Rose stories. That's my granddaughter. Let me tell you one more story. And this is about mom and dad. So I told you about Anna. Anna, she's the dried up, you know, hey, figure it out. Her husband, Douglas, is harder than she is. Anna has told me before, she said, Dad, I just don't understand it. Douglas is harder on Rose than I am. And yet she just goes to him. She just responds so eagerly to him. She'll spank him harder than I do. And yet she just wants nothing more than to receive his approval. It's because when earthly fathers discipline their children, they do what? They respect them. And that's what our children need to learn. As soon as our children know what the word know is, they need to understand that know means no. Don't touch that means don't touch that. And if they do, there's consequences immediately. As soon as they can understand the words come here, they need to understand that means come here. If they don't come here the first time, that's disobedience, and it will be punished. They need to understand when mom or dad says, pick up your toys, it means pick up your toys. And if it's not done, there are consequences. Now, this is not done for an ego trip. It's not done so that we will not be embarrassed in Walmart when they pitch a fit. That's not the purpose of this. It's so that they might respect our word. And by respecting us, guess who they're also learning to respect by extension? They're learning to respect God. And they're also, last five of the Ten Commandments, they're going to learn to be more respectful of others. Because what are they learning? The world doesn't revolve around me and my wants and my desires. I put others ahead of myself. The second lesson we learn is in verse 10. What's the purpose of discipline? He disciplines us for our good. And what is our good? What's the ultimate good? That we may share his holiness. Yes, if you discipline your kids to respect you, they're going to be more successful, most likely, in life. Well-disciplined kids. Have you ever heard the marshmallow experiment? It's where they put these little toddlers in a room where they put a marshmallow, a big marshmallow on the table, and they say, if you will not eat that marshmallow, I'm going to leave the room. And if that marshmallow is still there, I'm going to give you two marshmallows. And so the scientist, the clinician leaves the room, and they show the video, and it's really funny if you've ever seen this video. It's really funny. Some of those kids, they're like, they want that marshmallow so bad. And they're like, they kind of play with it. And, you know, some kids just give in, and they're like, no, I'm just going to eat it. You know, they pop it in their mouth, they eat it. Other kids wait, and they get two marshmallows. What they've learned with that little experiment with little toddlers, they have followed these kids on into their adolescent life and even into adulthood. And they found the kids that at a very early age, they could delay gratification and respect authority and obey what they're told not to do, that they perform better on the SAT and the ACT. They're less likely to end up as delinquents, for however you define that. They become more successful in life. Is that the goal of Christian parenting? That our kids might be more successful and get into the top colleges and get scholarships? Is that the purpose? The purpose of God is for our good, but He defines what the good is. That we may share His holiness. The purpose of our training, the purpose of our discipline, is that we might help our kids and equip our kids to become more like God. That's the goal. That's the highest good. That's the greatest dream we could ever dream for our children, is that they become disciples of Jesus Christ and bring Him glory. There's nothing greater than that. God has given us our children to prepare them for a lifetime of service to Him. We want our children to be independent of us and dependent on God. We want them to become disciples. That's why we train them. That's the only purpose. That's God's purpose in disciplining us. The third point is in verse 11. Later, talking about discipline, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Our children are happier when they are well trained. Tell me the truth. A child that is made to believe that everything revolves around them, do they really look happy as they're screaming at the top of their lungs in the middle of Walmart? Do they look happy to you? They don't look happy to me. Do they get what they want? Maybe. I'm not even sure that that's what they want. It's definitely not what they need. They need to learn obedience. They need to learn respect. Our children are happier. They're more at peace. They're more content. They feel safe and more secure. They know where the boundaries are. They're not left to wonder. They know that their parents love them. They know that because they can see that in the training. And not only that, they feel better about themselves. That's the blessing that comes from consistent discipline. Our children need this so that they can have the peaceful fruit of righteousness. There's only peace found when we are right with God. That's what we're made for. That's what almost in our bones we know that we're made for. And our children aren't going to discover that if they're just left to themselves. Undisciplined. Our children need humility. Our children need training. But finally, our children, above all, need God. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. This is where this is the last long passage we'll look at. Deuteronomy chapter 6, a very famous passage. And you know what it says? I know what it says, but we just need to be reminded of this, don't we? Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might, And these words that I command you shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That's where it all begins. There is only one God. No other God should take the place of God. No other idol. God is one. And before we can teach this diligently to our children, we must first understand that we shall love the Lord our God with all our heart, all your soul, and all your might. Everything must be devoted to Him. These words shall be on your heart. We can't teach our children something that we're not already doing. It's got to come from a place of sincerity, because if there's anything that children understand, it's hypocrisy. They know when mom and dad don't really mean it. And they're not going to accept a standard from us that we're not applying to ourselves. But we shall teach them diligently to our children. This must be the main goal. Yes, we want them to learn to read and write and math and all of those things they learn at school, but only as a function of helping prepare them for the greater goal of learning about God and being a servant of God, a disciple of God, to use these talents and abilities that we get from school to in service of God. This is what it's all about, is their spiritual training, not their physical training or anything else. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and in your gates. I think he's just saying this needs to be in the very fabric of your life. Everything about your life needs to be about the Lord. This just needs to be a part of your conversation all day long. When you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise, it just needs to be a part of your home. And let me say this. I mean, we as parents need to make family devotions and family Bible study such a regular part of our lives that the children come to expect it. I'll tell you one story real quick on this. There's a brother at university that he and his sons went camping one week on a weekend kind of retreat thing with other Christians, and it was a weekend full of Bible study. All they had done that whole evening was study the Bible with other men. And one of his sons, it was late, like 11 o'clock at night, and they were going into the tent to lie down after a weary, long day of travel and then Bible study. And his son said, "Dad, we haven't done our Bible reading." And Josh was like, he was so tired, and everybody else is, he's like, "Dad, we got to do our Bible reading." That's a good father. He did his Bible reading, because that's a part of their routine. And that's just what you do before you go to bed, is you do your Bible reading. That's Deuteronomy 6 in action. And let me say something quickly to grandparents, because I realize I'm speaking to a lot of grandparents this evening, and it's something that's been on my mind a lot lately. In fact, I did a lesson on grandparents not too long ago. I was just kind of curious. This sermon kind of began as my own personal study, where I was like, what does the Bible say about grandparents? It says more than you think. There's a lot of verses about generational faith and grandparents. We play a very important part in our children's lives. I remember having a Bible study on campus in Tuscaloosa with a small group of students, and we were going to go through that semester through Hebrews chapter 11, looking at the heroes of faith. And I just began the class, first class, I said, "Who are your heroes?" And so we went around the table. And you know, every single one of those kids, I think there were at least 10 kids, every single one of those kids mentioned a specific grandparent. And it's not because they didn't have good parents, but when they thought about their hero, about who they wanted to become, they mentioned a grandfather or a grandmother. And I could tell you about my grandparents and about the deep, profound influence they had on my life. And I pray that I can pass that on to my grandchildren. Let's not underestimate the importance of Deuteronomy 6. When our kids come over, yeah, feed them ice cream. You know, we can relax the rules a little bit. You know, we have that prerogative as grandparents. Let's not spoil them. Let's not ruin all that mom and dad have done. But let's enjoy our grandchildren. But let's realize that these are not just blessings for us to enjoy for their own, just because it's for our enjoyment. It's not about us. These are precious gifts from God, sent from heaven. And that's what these passages on grandparents are saying to us as grandparents, is we have just as much responsibility. It's different, but just as much responsibility in this stewardship of our grandchildren. And so let's take that role seriously and take advantage of those weekends that we have our grandkids, or whatever role you have with your kids. Let me say something quick about the stewardship we have. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. Psalm 127, verse 3, the fruit of the womb, a reward. Let's never think that these are our children. These are not just extensions of our ego. These are not chances of us fulfilling all the dreams that we didn't get to fulfill as a baseball player or in academics or professionally or whatever it is. These are blessings that are sent from God. They are given to us on loan. James Newman, when he prays for his kids, he will remind himself as he prays to God, and he'll say, Lord, you've given us these children on loan. We're someday going to give them back. And God's looking at us and expecting a return on the investment he has put in our lives. How are we doing with these blessings God has given us? They're stewardship. I love what Hannah says at the end of 1 Samuel 2, her prayer. As long as he lives, speaking of Samuel, whom she prayed for, he is lent to the Lord. Can we all say in our heart to the Lord, as long as he lives, as long as she lives, she's yours, he's yours. They are a stewardship from God. I know this series may seem overwhelming. We've covered a lot of ground, and there's much room for improvement. I've got so many things to work on in my life. Again, what we need to do is just break this down into smaller steps. Of the 100 things that I need to change, what's that one thing? What's that 1% that I can work on this week and make a meaningful difference? Here's the message of hope. Turn over to Ephesians 3. I want to end with these two verses at the end of Ephesians 3. After Paul has prayed for the brethren that they might know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that Christ might dwell in their hearts, that they might be filled with all the fullness of God, that's such a steep mountain. He's praying that we might climb and reach the summit. Notice how he ends in verse 20 and 21. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. It is a steep mountain that we're being called to climb. Understand, we're not doing it on our own steam. I don't know if this analogy works. This may be a terrible analogy. Have you ever ridden on an e-bike before? An e-bike is a bike that has a battery pack and a motor that works in conjunction with your pedaling. You're pedaling, but you feel like you have superpowers, you know, as you're going up that hill. Adrian and I took a vacation to Maine during the fall. Beautiful. We went to Acadia National Park, and there's all these carriage roads that go all the way through the park. Beautiful. But if it was just me and Adrian pedaling a regular bike, I'm not sure we would have been able to do all the carriage roads we did. We went miles and miles, but up and down and up and down. And you'd see this steep hill, and you'd start going up it, and you could feel it in your legs. You could feel it in your calves, but then that boost would kick in, and you're like, oh, I can make it up this hill, and you feel really stronger than you really are. Again, I don't know if that's a perfect analogy for this or not. But if you're feeling right now like, I just can't be the husband that I ought to be, or I can't do this as a wife, I can't do this as a parent, I just feel overwhelmed, understand what Paul is saying here. He's able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that you're asking or even thinking. You can't even imagine what God can do. That's where the e-bike fails. I mean, God is not an e-bike helping us up a hill. God is able. You may feel, I'm totally inadequate. I can't do it. Stop speaking that way. A Christian shouldn't speak that way. God is able to do beyond what you can ask or think. And so, what if you put in that 1%, that one thing that you're going to change this week? What happens when that 1% becomes 2, and that 2 becomes 4, and that 4 becomes 8, and that 8 becomes, you understand where we're going with this. What can God do with a little bit of faith? If you had faith as a mustard seed, how much does God need? Less than you think. And that's not to discourage you from effort. We are to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. So may God help us as we all strive to climb up that mountain. If you're not a child of God, though, none of this series means anything. The only thing that matters is, have I put my faith in Jesus Christ? Have I confessed Him as Lord? Have I been immersed with Him in the watery grave to rise to walk in newness of life? Because you can be the best parent in the world. You can do all the things we talked about as a husband or a wife or as a brother or sister. You can do all these things perfectly. It means nothing if you haven't started the race. And it's only by God's grace that we can be saved. And so if you're ready to do that tonight and begin this journey, why don't you come this evening as together we stand and sing.